Chris Hedges, talking about the Reverend Daniel Berrigan's life, he says we should emulate, wrote this, "Berrigan is one of the nation's most courageous voices for justice." And then quoting Berrigan, Hedges writes, "Faith always starts with oneself. It means an overriding sense of responsibility for the universe, making sure that the universe is left in good hands, and the belief that things will finally turn out right if we remain faithful." So if we remain faithful, it will turn out all right. Do you still have that faith? Do you still believe that?
In an existential sense, yes. In a practical sense, perhaps not. We are emulating, as anthropologists like Tainter or Redman or others have chronicled in Collapse of Past Civilizations, all of the mistakes that complex societies have made over 5,000 years of human civilization. And the difference is that this time when our civilization goes down, the whole planet's going to go down with us. The folly of allowing the fossil fuel industry to determine our relationship to the ecosystem. The folly of embracing an ideology of limitless expansion and consumption. At this point, it's quite clear what the consequences of that will be. And yet, we cannot wrest ourselves from these systems or from the benefits that those of us in the wealthy industrialized world derive from these systems. And I think that Berrigan certainly sees all of that. And yet he makes that leap, which I also make, from the practical to the moral. And as Father Berrigan says, we're called to do the good, or at least the good insofar as we can determine it, and then we have to let it go. That the Buddhists call it karma, that for us it's the belief that the good draws to it the good. That rebellion and resistance itself is a moral imperative. And even though empirically everything around us may appear to deteriorate, it doesn't invalidate that act of resistance. But I read the climate science reports, including one not long ago by the World Bank, which is pretty apocalyptic. I think especially looking at how past societies and past civilizations have crumbled. I studied classics at Harvard. You can look at the fall of the Roman Empire, or the Mesopotamian Empire, or the Mayan Empire. At the end, your elites retreat into self-protected enclaves, forbidden cities, Versailles, just as our elite has utterly unplugged itself from day-to-day reality. I think a New Yorker writer called it Richistan. They don't fly commercial airlines. There's one set of laws and regulations for the 99% and a whole another set of laws and regulations with their lobbyists right for themselves. They live in a kind of parallel universe. They don't understand, and yet they are the ones who are relentlessly exploiting both human capital and finally the environment for short-term profit. I mean, 40% of the summer Arctic sea ice melts and Shell Oil looks at it as a business opportunity. We're talking about the death throes of the planet. And they're dropping $1.5 billion drill bit after another. There's a scramble for the last vestiges of fish stocks, oil, gas, minerals. It's utter insanity. I wrote a column last week that said, Melville's the most prescient sort of oracle in American culture, because we're all on the Pequot. We're all headed off on this insane quest, which I think in rational moments we even understand will kill us. And yet we can't free ourselves from it.
Here's what Chris wrote. "And so we plunge forward in our doomed quest to master the forces that will finally smite us. Those who see where we are going lack the fortitude to rebel. Mutiny was the only salvation for the Pequod's crew. It's our only salvation. But moral cowardice turns us into hostages. Moby Dick rams and sinks the Pequod. The waves swallow up Ahab and all who follow him, except one. A vortex formed by the ship's descent collapses," end quote. and the great shroud of the sea rolled on as it rolled 5,000 years ago. It's pretty gloomy, the outlook. Some people have critiqued some of your writing, especially more recently, that it's kind of gloomy, that people are left feeling like the sea is going to sort of overtake us and there isn't much we could do. Just one more thing. In the same article about Berrigan, you wrote, "The failure by large numbers of citizens to carry out mass acts of civil disobedience will only ensure that we remain hostages to corporate power." You're disappointed in not seeing more civil disobedience.
Because the formal mechanisms of power don't work. We've undergone what John Ralston Saul calls correctly a coup d'etat, corporate coup d'etat in slow motion, and it's over. They've won. We live in what the political philosopher Sheldon Wolin calls a system of inverted totalitarianism. And by that he means it's not classical totalitarianism. It doesn't find its expression through a demagogue or a charismatic leader, but through the anonymity of the corporate state. That in classical totalitarian regimes, you have a reactionary or revolutionary party that replaces one structure with another. In inverted totalitarianism, you have corporate forces that purport to be loyal to the Constitution, electoral politics, the iconography and language of American patriotism, and yet internally have seized all of the levers of power to render the citizen impotent. And so that this political theater, which we are witnessing, is a charade. The Democrats are as beholden to corporate power as the Republicans. The judiciary has become a wholly owned subsidiary of the corporate state. And our only hope left is to build mass movements of dissent, and I covered the revolutions in Eastern Europe, that can wrest power back from this rapacious corporate elite that quite literally will kill us. And I see, of course, it's bleak. And you know, I'm sorry, the climate science reports are bleak. I'm not making it up. This kind of mania for hope is really a kind of sickness, because it prevents us from seeing how dire and catastrophic the situation is if we don't radically reconfigure our relationship to each other and to the ecosystem. And so, of course, people don't want to hear it. You know, they want to become entranced or mesmerized with the trivia that dominates the airwaves and the sagas and soap operas. And, you know, we are fed this mantra that is really fiction. And the mantra goes that we can have everything we want, that reality is never an impediment to what we desire. And that's given to us by Oprah, and it's given to us by Hollywood.
That's
and
why
the Christian
calling this show reality.
Well,
asserts itself, because you can think that.
Right.
But.
And it's a lie. It's not true. And I think we can't even use the word hope until we confront reality and begin to resist against the real. If we're resisting against a fantasy or fiction, if we believe that Barack Obama is going to save us, then, you know, it's like writing letters to Uncle Joe Stalin, if he only knew what they were doing here out in, you know, the Ukrainian wheat fields, where, of course, millions of people died for the famine, then everything we do is futile. So I think it's fundamental that we grasp reality in order to build effective resistance. And unfortunately, reality at this moment in human history is pretty bleak.
So how much of this lack of mass movement, although we need to say there is one, there are things happening all over the country and certainly all over the world. I mean, in some places, from Brazil to Egypt, surprising things are happening.
Right.
It's complicated, but things are happening.
Right.
On the other hand, we're not seeing this kind of even Brazilian-style mass movement here, and certainly not a wide-scale civil disobedience movement. But how much is that the responsibility, weakness, if you want, fault of the American left? In 2008, in a piece you wrote, "Why Am I a Socialist?" you wrote this: "The inability to articulate a viable socialism has been our gravest mistake." Do you still believe that?
Yes, because we have allowed ourselves to embrace an ideology which, at its core, states that all governance is about maximizing corporate profit at the expense of the citizenry. For what do we have structures of government? For what do we have institutions of state if not to hold up all the citizenry and especially the most vulnerable? You know, if you go back and look at the 1980s in especially the Scandinavian countries, they eradicated poverty virtually. I lived in Switzerland. I studied French in Switzerland. And there were no homeless. The mentally ill were taken care of. It has arguably one of the best healthcare systems in the world. My oldest son was born in Lausanne. And that was, it's actually a privatized system, but it's heavily regulated. Everybody pays into it, but everybody has health insurance. Senior public school teachers earned about as much as doctors. And with the wealth given to us as Americans, we could have eradicated poverty. We could have created a country that was much different than what we have created. And what's happening now is that we are being rapidly reconfigured into a kind of neo-feudal society, an oligarchic society where increasingly the bottom two-thirds of Americans are hanging on by their fingertips. You have a shrinking, diminishing middle class and an elite that is just making obscene amounts of money at our expense. And you can't sustain, first of all, you can't sustain a democracy and an oligarchy. That's not a new idea. Thucydides wrote about that, about ancient Athens. But secondly, because there are no self-imposed limits, and in this sense, Karl Marx was right, that unfettered, unregulated capitalism, especially on a global scale, is a revolutionary force. They will push and push and push until there is a backlash. And I think part of what we're seeing with the security and surveillance state is a preparation for that backlash. The destruction of civil liberties, which has been brutal. The wholesale surveillance and monitoring of, you know, virtually every American citizen, which I think many of us suspected, and Edward Snowden, through his disclosures to Glenn Greenwald at The Guardian, made palpably real. The National Defense Authorization Act, and I sued the president in the Southern District Court of New York, and I won. The Obama administration has appealed it. But this permits the military to seize, arrest American citizens, strip them of due process, and hold them in military detention centers, including our offshore penal colonies in places like Guantanamo or Bagram. And when Judge Catherine Forrest wrote her 112-page opinion, which I think is worth reading, she actually brings up the plight of the 110,000 Japanese-Americans who were interned during World War II and stripped of due process, and said that this provision in the NDAA essentially allows the state to criminalize an entire group of people and lock them away without any legal redress. And they know what's coming. The NSA has run all sorts of scenarios on economic collapse and especially climate change, and they're preparing.
Let me add one thing to that. We did this in our coverage of the G20 protests in Toronto, where 1,000 people were arrested.
Right.
But I think there's pretty clear evidence that when they arrest 1,000 people in Toronto, when there's very little happening,
right,
this is dress rehearsal. This is training for how do you do
right,
mass arrests.
And it's also a message to everyone else. I mean, let's remember that whatever the internal faults of the Occupy movement, and they were there, the Occupy movement was destroyed. And I was just at a trial in New York, Veterans for Peace, 25 people arrested. I was there in October 7th at the Vietnam Veterans Memorial Plaza in New York, which technically closes at 10, but that's never enforced unless you're carrying out a public demonstration, that there is now a decision by the security and surveillance state to essentially seize all public space, to make any kind of protests within public space impossible because they don't want to see generated another Occupy movement. And indeed, when many of these vets were arrested, the cops were telling them, look, we're vets, we don't want to arrest you, but the Occupy movement messed it up for you because we can't allow another one. The state was quite rattled by the Occupy movement and is determined not to allow a movement, a mass movement like that, to rise up again. And yet, you know, you read Paul Krugman's columns in the New York Times, where he constantly calls for a rational response to the economic crisis. And a rational response would be a moratorium on foreclosures and bank repossessions, a forgiveness of student debt, a massive jobs program, rebuilding infrastructure, especially targeted people under the age of 25. That would be rational. But the state doesn't respond rationally because There are no mechanisms, counter mechanisms now to make piecemeal or incremental reform possible, which was the role of the traditional liberal class, and I spend a long time in The Death of the Liberal Class laying this out. And so they keep pushing and pushing and pushing. You're seeing unemployment benefits being taken away. You're seeing Head Start programs being shut down. You're seeing an assault on public education. The Congress can't even cap the student debt at 3%. It's now risen to 6%, while at the same time the Fed is lending trillions of dollars to corporations like Goldman Sachs at virtually 0% interest. And then these financial corporations, especially if you're late on your credit card, are charging us upwards to 30%. I don't know what that is. It's not capitalism. It's extortion. And that's the system that we live under. So because there are no self-imposed limits, there will be a response. It may not look like Occupy. It may not call itself Occupy. Indeed, I don't think that it will. But I've covered movements all over the world. I covered the revolutions in East Germany, Czechoslovakia, Romania. I covered both of the Palestinian uprisings or intifadas. I covered the street demonstrations that brought down Milosevic. And you know as a reporter that the tinder is there. So having spent 2 years writing Days of Destruction, Days of Revolt out of the very poorest pockets of the country with Joe Sacco, and having been, in cities like Camden, which per capita is the poorest city in the United States and not surprisingly the most dangerous, something's coming. What will trigger it? It will be benign. It will be a seemingly innocuous event.
In Brazil, it was bus fares.
There you go. In the first Palestinian uprising, it was a traffic accident. But something's coming. Now, I should add that in American society, we have a long tradition of extremist, vigilante, right-wing violence, which can be categorized as fascist, where you fuse the language and iconography of the state with the Christian religion, where you demonize the vulnerable, Muslims, undocumented workers, homosexuals, intellectuals, liberals, feminists. They have a long list of people they hate. And those are powerful forces within American society. The left has been destroyed, especially the radical left, quite consciously in the whole name of anti-communism, and the death of the liberal class really explains the destruction of those movements. But those movements were important because, as Howard Zinn points out, in the people's history of the United States, they opened up the democratic space, that the people who founded this country were slave-holding white male oligarchs. Who were terrified, and you can see it in the Federalist Papers, of any kind of popular democracy. And so that all of the advances within American society and within the industrialized world, we had the bloodiest, deadliest labor wars of any country. Hundreds of workers were killed. Thousands were wounded. The violence was quite brutal and quite extreme. And so you saw with the abolitionists, with the labor movement, with the suffragists, even with the civil rights movement, movements outside the power structure, condemned as radical, that forced a liberal elite to respond and open up space. Now the radical movements are gone and destroyed, and more importantly, the liberal institutions have been disemboweled to serve corporate interests. So what the result is that we as citizens have, through the traditional structures of power, been left powerless to respond. The only hope left is to get out in the street and build the kind of mass movements that I saw in countries like East Germany, where you had 500,000 people showing up in Alexanderplatz in East Berlin, or 500,000 people showing up in the streets of Prague and in Wenceslas Square during the Velvet Revolution, which I also covered. I'm not naive enough to tell you it's going to work. Appealing to the better nature of the Democratic Party, I can assure you, is not going to work.
But doesn't this mass movement need some kind of electoral strategy?
I'm not sure that it does. I think that the problem is, and Karl Popper writes this in The Open Society and Its Enemies, he said, the question is not how do you get good people to rule. Popper says that's the wrong question. Most people, Popper writes, attracted to power are at best mediocre, which is Obama, or venal, which is Bush. The question is, how do you make the power elite frightened of you? Who was the last liberal president we had? It was Richard Nixon. Not because he was a liberal, but because he was frightened of movements. And there's a scene, I think it's in Kissinger's memoirs, 1971, huge anti-war demonstration surrounding the White House. And Nixon has put empty buses, city buses, end to end as a kind of barricade. And he's standing at the window, wringing his hands, going, "Henry, they're going to break through the barricades and get us." And that's just where you want power, people in power, to be. And that's why Sarkozy, who was a cretin, was unable to do too much damage to France. Because if you got up in France and told French university students that they were going to pay $50,000 a year to go to college, they shut the damn country down. And we have to recognize that for those of us who care about defending the rights of the underclass, we have to hold fast to the moral imperatives of movements and force power to respond to those movements. If we integrate those movements into the power structure, if we, in essence, compromise the integrity of those movements, we diminish their power. And that goes back to Julian Benda, his great work, The Treason of Intellectuals, where he says all of us have the option of serving two sets of principles, privilege and power, or justice and truth. But for those of us who care about privilege and power, the more we make concessions to those who serve privilege and power, for those of us who care about justice and truth, the more we diminish the capacity for justice and truth. The point is to build organizations that make the power elite frightened of us. And if we invest our energy, as I think the left unfortunately has, into political parties, or at least, let's say, the Democratic Party, and I wrote Nader's major policy speeches for him in 2008 and voted for Gene Stein in the last election, but as a kind of protest vote, then all of the programs that I think we so desperately need in a democratic state are going to be destroyed. I mean, Roosevelt was a compromise figure. You had the Communist Party, you had the Progressive Party, you had anarcho-syndicalist unions like the Wobblies, you had a radical left that was putting pressure. So Roosevelt says that his greatest achievement is that he saved capitalism, and he's right. And most of the policies that he adopted, he took from the left.
But to go back to what you wrote, the inability to articulate a viable socialism has been our gravest mistake. In the 30s, there was a movement, for better or worse, that had a vision of something to fight for. It wasn't just to fight against. That's what I'm saying.
But I'm saying that we have to hold, you have to hold fast to that moral imperative. So if you keep conceding, I mean, let's look at what the liberal class has conceded to the Democratic Party. The Democratic Party in Europe would be a far-right party. It's pro-war, it's anti-union, it's anti-civil liberties. I mean, Obama's assault on civil liberties is worse than Bush. It's an enemy of the press. It's used the Espionage Act to shut down whistleblowers, which are the lifeblood of a free press. It has assassinated American citizens. I mean, at what point do you say enough? And I think that Nader was correct when he ran for president by saying, if we can get 5, 10, 15 million people to withdraw from the system as a kind of counterweight, we can begin to put pressure from the other side. But right now, there is no pressure from the other side because we are effectively manipulated. Look, both sides of the political spectrum are manipulated by the same forces. If you're some right-wing Christian zealot in Georgia, then it's homosexuals and abortion and all these, you know, wedge issues that are used to whip you up emotionally. If you are a liberal in Manhattan, it's they'll all be teaching creationism in your schools or whatever. Yet, in fact, it's just a game. Because whether it's Bush or whether it's Obama, a Goldman Sachs wins, always. There is no way to vote against the interests of Goldman Sachs. And it's only by stepping outside the system and challenging the system, and we can do that through electoral politics, which is what Debs did, 1912. I think he polled 6% of the vote. But that doesn't mean that we'll take power. It just means that we will begin to build forces that will pressure power to respond. And I think that's what we've forgotten. We have to begin to make the power elite terrified of us. And Occupy did that, by the way. They were terrified of Occupy. And you saw in the elections...
Because they thought it would really catch on.
Well,
bigger than it was.
And they had to destroy it. And let's remember who destroyed it. Barack Obama destroyed it in a coordinated federal campaign because the people who were most threatened by Occupy were the Democrats, which is why they tried to co-opt the language and they sent out Van Jones, you know, Occupy the ballot booth and all this kind of stuff. In the same way they were threatened by Nader, 2000. They were terrified of Nader, which is Nader's mortal enemy became the Democratic Party, challenging all his voter lists, which, of course, made him spend millions in legal fees to fight back, demonizing him for the election of Bush, when in fact Bush was appointed by fiat by the Supreme Court. It had nothing to do with Nader. They didn't do the recount in Florida because Gore had won. What I'm saying is that you can have an electoral strategy, but an electoral strategy is not going to include embracing the Democratic Party.
Millions of people unemployed. Millions of people have lost their houses. Now, for a long time, the left was saying, the crash is coming, the crash is coming, the people will rise up. Well, the crash came, and some people rose up, but not in the kind of critical numbers that would have shaken, or as in the previous episode you said, terrified the elites. Why?
Because the traditional liberal elite divorced itself from the issue of justice to embrace, for the last few decades, issues such as gender equality, multiculturalism, identity politics, all of which I support. But while they busied themselves with these activities, the working class was being destroyed through NAFTA and the outsourcing of jobs, the stagnation, in essence, reduction of the minimum wage. The Democratic Party used to watch out for the interests of labor and even for the poor. But that all changed under Bill Clinton. Although Clinton, like Obama, continues to speak in that feel your pain language of traditional liberalism, they've completely betrayed the very people that they purport to represent and defend.
And even the previous ones, I mean, Truman on, they had a chance at many times, for example, to undo Taft-Hartley.
Right.
You know, terrible anti-labor legislation,
right.
And they never undid it.
They never did, although Truman did try to push through universal health care.
The union movement and union leadership, you know, at times during Democratic administrations can get critical, but when push comes to the shove, they never threaten the Democrats in any way. And maybe the worst example of it has been with the Obama administration, where in the lead up to the election, Obama promises them EFCA, the Employee Free Choice Act, which is going to make it easier to organize unorganized workers. In the first 2 years where they control both houses, doesn't come forward, and of course afterwards you never see it, and now we don't even hear it again. And I interviewed John Sweeney at the time, head of the AFL-CIO, and I said, what are you going to do if President Obama doesn't pass this? He's going to pass it. He's going to pass it. He's never going to betray us. And of course, he did betray them, and the union movement was out again in the next election, just as if nothing had happened.
Right. Well, these people, I mean, the heads of these unions pull down salaries that are five times what the rank and file pulls down. They negotiate deals such as they did with the auto bailout, where their most senior unionized workers have their wages reduced, and the auto companies are allowed to hire new workers at $14 an hour without benefits. So they sell out the younger workers to protect, to an extent, older workers. They have no kind of vision of what kind of a country they want to create, i.e. one that would actually respond to the needs of the working class. And, you know, I think they're pretty bankrupt. I mean, they have become part of the establishment, and rhetorically they can get up and say all the right things in the same way that Barack Obama can get up and say all the right things. But in the end, you know, it's Wall Street and the corporations that are pulling the strings on the puppets.
I talked to a behind-the-scenes organizer for the unions. He advises them on policy and things. And I asked him, why do you guys not contend for some kind of leadership of the Democratic Party? And his answer was, well, Wall Street is the only one, pro-Democratic Party Wall Street, is the only one with enough cash to beat the Republicans, so we can't take them on.
Right, and the unions don't. I mean, the Democrats will still take their money, but it's a fraction of the money that fills the coffers of the Democratic Party. Most of the money comes from, you know, these massive Wall Street firms and corporations that can dwarf anything that the union can provide.
Perhaps it goes back to something you were saying before as well about how the liberal elites, you said, kind of got disassociated from working class issues.
Right.
So the fight within the unions for what kind of leadership, for what kind of union, it kind of was going on somewhere over here, and the left was somewhere over there. And not that there weren't activists in the unions fighting, but they were kind of on their own.
Well, and meanwhile, the working class was being decimated. So that now our working class is largely enveloped within the service sector, where couples will have two or three different jobs with no kind of benefits, no kind of security. It's just Walmart Nation. There is no force within either of the established political parties that are willing to stand up and defend the interest, even on the issue of minimum wage. Again, that's only going to come by stepping outside the formal mechanisms of power and beginning to build movements, as we saw with the Chicago teacher strike. I mean, let's remember that the Chicago teacher strike was fighting against a Democratic mayor, not just any mayor, but one of the pillars of the Democratic establishment, Rahm Emanuel, that they had to essentially remove the traditional leadership. And that's really going to be the future. That we're we're fighting both parties. We're not fighting one party.
And the teachers were willing to make the sacrifice to fight when they had a leadership that wanted to go there.
That's right.
In the beginning of the interview, I asked you why the left hasn't been able to take more advantage of this moment. And you talked a bit about the failure of the liberal elite. But why should a people's movement, why should a working class movement, why should it matter what the liberal elite does or doesn't do? I mean, one would assume the liberal elite, when push comes to shove, are a part of the elite.
Yes, they are. Well, that is, as Noam Chomsky has pointed out, the role of the liberal establishment, to act as a kind of safety valve, to ameliorate the suffering and respond to some of the grievances of the underclass, to right the system, which is, again, going back to the New Deal, precisely what happened. Roosevelt and Henry Wallace functioned as traditional liberal leaders function, and they keep the system afloat. Now, the problem is that the radical movements that were able to push the liberal elites to respond have been destroyed. We don't have any anymore. In the long war against our internal and external enemies in the name of anti-communism, they've been utterly decimated, culminating in the 1950s with these huge purges. Ellen Schrecker has written two good books about this. Thousands of high school teachers, social workers, artists, directors, journalists like I.F. Stone were pushed out.
And particularly trade unionists.
And trade unionists. So you end up with these distortions like in the 1960s, Meany and Kirkland, who support Nixon's war in Indochina, denounce the hippies in the street. I mean, when Joe Sacco and I did our book, Days of Destruction, Days of Revolt, one of the chapters is out of southern West Virginia. Now, pre-World War I, Mother Jones was a hero to the miners, like John Lewis and all of these radical figures. Now it's Sarah Palin and Michelle Bachmann. Why is that? It's because that there's been a divorce of radical movements from the working class and radical ideologies from the working class. And the way that divorce came about is that those who had these kind of broad social visions, which challenged the primacy of corporate capitalism, got pushed out of the system. They're not there anymore. And so now at a moment of crisis, and we are certainly in a moment of crisis, we lack the movements which can give expression to the suffering of our underclass, and our liberal elites, which once responded to those movements, have been eviscerated and essentially are corporate stooges.
And it kind of goes together. When the movement's so weak, a lot of the elite says, well, we don't need the safety valve because the pressure's not building.
Well, that's precisely the problem. There is no pressure from the other side. And the liberal elites, you know, while they can speak in a rhetoric that is reminiscent of that rhetoric, and Obama does it, certainly, serves their paymasters, which are Wall Street and defense contractors and the fossil fuel industry.
Are you seeing any positive signs? For example, people are enthused about Bernie Sanders getting elected in Vermont. There's the, what do you make of some of the third party options? The Green Party didn't have a lot of electoral success, but they did run a lot of candidates. Well, what significance is this kind of stuff?
I voted for the Green Party as a kind of protest vote, just as I have voted for Nader before that. And I think the more of us who are willing to step outside the system and, in essence, vote that way, the more we can begin to build pressure. But electoral politics is a very minor part of what we have to do. What we really have to do is build mass movements that muck up the system enough that we can begin to interfere with the mechanisms of power. And what I'm talking about are strikes, disruption of public transportation, which we would see in France, for instance, farmers driving their tractors into the middle of Paris. It's that kind of stuff that we're going to have to build, and we're not going to build that any other way than, you know, almost starting all over again.
So what's holding people back? I mean, we're in a very difficult situation for millions of people, but we're not seeing that. And you know, the liberal elite being weak in some ways, one could follow the logic, then there should be more reason for this to be happening, not less.
Well, because the mechanisms of control, as any Walmart worker will tell you, are quite severe. I mean, the moment there's a whisper of organizing at a Walmart store, the corporate jet flies in with all their strike union breakers.
Although with some success recently with some of these strikes.
The forces arrayed against us, the security and surveillance state, knows the moment anything is going to be organized. They've essentially shut down all public space for any kind of serious dissent because they don't want to see a resurrection of the Occupy movement. We are the most surveilled, monitored, eavesdropped, controlled, watched population in human history, and I speak as somebody who covered the Stasi state in East Germany. We are kept in a state of perpetual fear that we could lose our jobs. I mean, and so many people in this country now are living at subsistence level. To lose their job is catastrophic. We are seeing the corporate state dismantle programs that once provided benefits like unemployment payments or social programs to the poor, to the elderly, to students, to make us even more frightened and more easily manipulated. I mean, there's a kind of awful logic to what they're doing. And, you know, it is that those forms of repression are quite effective. We have shifted, I think, from a democratic state to a species of corporate totalitarianism. Our media is, you know, largely drivel. Celebrity gossip will dominate even the nightly news programs of the three major networks. MSNBC, you know, will spin the court gossip one way. Fox spins it another, but it's the same stupid gossip. Neither of those cable companies covered the National Defense Authorization Act, our challenge.
But you said in an earlier episode, and I agree with you, the moment will come.
Yes, it will come.
Right now they've been able to kind of limit the effects of this crisis, but a lot of it has to do with a lot of hokey-pokey going on by the Fed.
Right.
You know, the underlying wages are either stagnant or going down. The unemployment is really not going down. I mean, the real economy is in as bad a shape as it was.
But how, if it comes, will it be localized? And if it's localized, it can be dealt with locally. Will it have a kind of broad national vision? Will it articulate a new system of power to replace
That's what I'm concerned about as a citizen. I mean, whatever the journalist hat is supposed to be here, which is, I was at dinner the other night with some people having somewhat similar conversation. Why isn't there a mass movement and all of this? And I was saying, be careful what you wish for. You know, if there was a big explosion tomorrow, you know, would any progressive force actually be ready for it?
Right.
Because it could easily, as you said earlier, you know, the right could grab hold of this as well.
Well, right-wing populism or fascism is a very real possibility. And I think that we are particularly vulnerable to that because our progressive, populist, and radical movements virtually don't exist, and because the liberal center is so discredited. If you go back and read Dostoevsky, Notes from Underground Demons, Dostoevsky was obsessed, I mean, that's what Notes from Underground is about, with a liberal class that is superfluous, that no longer has any actual authority or power within the society and has become a joke. I saw the same thing in the breakdown of Yugoslavia, which I covered as a correspondent, where you had a liberal center that, in essence, is paralyzed. It can't respond. And that's what's happened. We have a system of political paralysis that responds only to the dictates of the corporate elite, not to the needs and the rights of the citizenry. And so when you have figures like Obama who continue to speak in that traditional language of liberalism, and yet cannot respond to chronic unemployment, underemployment, foreclosures, bank repossessions, and everything else. And in fact, are running a system where the assaults against the underclass are only getting worse, then what happens is there becomes a deep disdain for not only liberal ideology, but traditional liberal institutions. You saw the same thing in Weimar. So that when there is an uprising, oftentimes, people want nothing to do with not only liberal elites, but the supposed liberal values, quote unquote, that these elites were purportedly espousing. And that is a very real danger, because when you have figures like Obama that present themselves as traditional liberals and yet are unable to be effective in terms of dealing with the suffering and the misery of the underclass, when things exploded, you vomited up these very frightening figures, Radovan Karadzic, Slobodan Milosevic, Franjo Tuđman, in the same way that the breakdown in Weimar vomited up the Nazi Party. And that's what frightens me, because we don't have the movements, the populist movements on the left, and because we live in a system of political paralysis. So Dostoevsky said that, you know, that system leads to what he calls an age of moral nihilism and ultimately violence, which is what, at the end of Crime and Punishment, Raskolnikov's dream is about. So, and Dostoevsky was nothing if not deeply prescient about where that was going. So I'm frightened. I'm frightened because without these movements, you know, we are not immune to these kinds of forces should we suffer economic collapse coupled with environmental catastrophe, which of course creates economic disruption, $70 billion of damage in the last hurricane season. Little that hurricane's a Category 2. Tornadoes and hurricanes the size of we've never seen in human history, these aren't going away. So, you know, we could really see ourselves headed for a very disturbing kind of dystopia.
So, people watching this, what would you suggest they do next?
We have to begin to build organizations to protect ourselves from corporate forces that are determined to exploit the ecosystem until it collapses. We have to recognize that the implantation of global capitalism is one that will reconfigure the world into a kind of neo-feudal society where workers here will be told that they have to be competitive with sweatshop workers in Bangladesh who make 22 cents an hour, prison labor in China. That's already happening. We have to recognize that the vast corporate systems that we have set up, for instance, our food system is very fragile and not sustainable. Food must once again be local. We can't continue to feed ourselves on a system where we're shipping all of our fruits and vegetables from California or Florida across the country. That means beginning to, and more than community gardens, but essentially buying local, creating sustainable systems that are local. Because when things go down, the elites will withdraw within to their gated compounds where they will have access to security, water, medical facilities, all sorts of things that they will deny to the rest of us. They're not going to take care of us when things come, when things go bad. And we have to begin to prepare for that. It's not a very pleasant scenario. It's not pleasant to think about. But it's survivable if we begin to respond to what's coming. As long as we remain unplugged, as long as we are checked out, which is how they want us, we're going to be left defenseless.
Some of what you've suggested people are doing. I mean, there are organizations that are trying to speak about the environment. There's organizations speaking about housing and unemployment and this and that. And so people still left wondering, what can I do that would make a difference to this? Because the current kind of left politics, while there's breakthroughs in certain places, you talked about Chicago teachers, and there was a rebellion in Wisconsin, big protests in Wisconsin. Things happen, and across the country, there's many more things happen than we know about.
Right.
And we try to cover some of this on the real news. We don't really have the capacity to cover all that's happening. And I think if we, you know, because it's not getting enough coverage, and certainly the mainstream media, people think nothing's happening. And in fact, more is than a lot of us think is, but not at the scale, you know, that would make the kind of changes that you know you're suggesting we need. So people are still left with like, what's the key link for what's next?
Well, the more we create self-sustainable systems that are local, the more we sever ourselves from these corporate forces, the less we need them. And the less we need them, I mean, let's remember that 70% of the U.S. economy is driven through consumption. The less we need them, the more we impoverish them. I mean, the goal has to be to break these corporate power, this entity that has seized control of our government, our systems of communication, our judiciary. I mean, now we're watching them eviscerate our systems of education. Anytime hedge fund managers walk into a city like Baltimore and propose charter schools, it's not because they want to teach people to read and write. It's because they know the federal government spends about $600 billion a year in education. They want it, and they're getting it. So I think that building local centers that are self-sustaining and that can create forms of community that are not dependent on these corporate forces is a political act, because these corporate forces need us to continue to consume their products and rely on their services. And the less we consume and the less we are hostage, the less we need these forces, the more independent we become. Now, that has to come with a kind of political consciousness, but I think they come hand in hand, that both things, I think that as people take control once again of their own lives, that will bring a kind of consciousness, because these corporate forces, especially if they begin to feel threatened, are going to see these acts as political acts and are going to move, as we have seen corporate farming move against organic farming, they are going to move to try and destroy these forces.
One of the things I don't think the left talks about very much in the United States and Canada and maybe in many countries for different reasons, they don't often talk about who owns stuff. There's a lot of talk about lack of fair distribution. There's a lot of talk about the power of the state, and all rightly so. But who owns stuff doesn't get talked about that much. And in the piece you wrote, in terms of you said this gravest mistake is not articulating a vision of what a democratic socialism might look like.
Right.
And you talk about nationalizing the energy companies and other kinds of things like that. Is part of what's missing is that doesn't seem to be part of the left discourse in any kind of unified way. Like, you have a big protest, there's like 30 different things get talked about in terms of demands and issues. I mean, what got the Brazilian thing going recently was very specific. It was bus fares.
Right.
And in Quebec, it was tuition.
Right.
And here, it's like, there's always like 30 things, and then you have a debate about why isn't it more focused, and it becomes a virtue not to be focused.
Well, because, you know, as somebody who identifies himself as a socialist, I have no voice in the mainstream. You're not going to hear my voice. To even call yourself a socialist in this country is to essentially remove yourself from the acceptable parameters of public discourse.
Including in the movement?
The movement is so fractious, and the movement is so diffuse that, I mean, I think, you know, let's go back to the Occupy movement. I think a lot of that is, I look at it as a very kind of new, green, maybe even immature expression, but it's a beginning. You know, if we are going to build effective social and political movements that defy power, they're going to have to do a lot of things that were not done in Occupy, like become very disciplined and focused and delineate between what is right and wrong. I mean, part of the Occupy movement is they had that kind of bourgeois liberal notion that of tolerance, you know, everything is okay. Well, everything isn't okay. You know, if we're going to build a political force that is going to counter systems of power that seek to destroy us, you know, some things are not acceptable and some things are acceptable. And I think many of the Occupy activists, you know, and I was associated with the Wall Street movement, Zuccotti, really came to that understanding. I mean, they lost control of the park when the individual tents went up. Activists were spending all night in de-escalation teams to stop fights. When the drugs came in, the cops were dropping off homeless people. They were taking people out of Rikers and dropping off it because they knew that they could overload the system to destroy it. And they did, coupled with all the infiltrations and surveillance and everything else. So we're just beginning. I think part of that is a political maturation that begins to articulate what it is that we want. At least they know what they don't want. They don't want ExxonMobil determining our children's relationship to the environment. But that really means that we have to destroy ExxonMobil.
You got to change who owns stuff.
Well, you have to nationalize. You have to build an energy system that is responsive to the needs of the citizenry, not to a corporate board, which is awash in tens, if not hundreds, of millions of personal wealth. I think that's coming. I think those questions are being asked. I think we're in this kind of strange period when the language we use to describe our economic and political system no longer matches the reality. I mean, laissez-faire capitalism. We don't live in a system of laissez-faire capitalism when the federal government bails out these institutions to the tunes of trillions of dollars and then keeps pumping out free money from the Fed and handing it to... It's not laissez-faire capitalism, and yet I'm sure that if you went to Wharton or Harvard Business School, they would still be teaching this fictional system. And we haven't yet moved into a period where the vocabulary we use to describe our reality matches that reality. And that's always a revolutionary period because there's a disconnect between the way we speak about ourselves and the way we actually function. And that's where we are. And so we, in many ways, are searching for the words to describe what's happening to us and then to articulate another vision of where we want to go. And we haven't gotten there yet.
I may be well proved wrong on this, but I think the emperor has no clothes moment is that I think the older of us who grew up in the Cold War and have all the memories of all this, we're way more hung up on the word socialism than young people are. I don't think they're very hung up on it. And there was a really interesting moment in the 2008 elections. In the last couple of weeks, when Obama's starting to pull away, McCain pulls out, he's a socialist, you're a socialist, you're a socialist. And that was going to be the thing right. that scare everybody. And it's the one thing I thought Obama hit a great note. I don't think he believed it, but he hit a great note. When he was accused, he's asked, are you a socialist? He said, well, my Bible teaches me I am my brother's keeper.
Right.
And the whole thing went away.
Right.
And there was a magazine, we're all socialists now, there were surveys, the young people don't care, they're not worried about the term. I mean, one of the great achievements I thought of Occupy was you could actually talk about capitalism right. as a system.
Right.
But then you also got to talk about an alternative.
Right. I think Occupy was getting there. Occupy was, I like to think of it as a tactic, not a movement, in the same way that, Rosa Parks gets on the bus and it's 5 years before the Freedom Riders get on their bus. I look at Occupy like that, that what comes next, something will come. It will build on what came before. It will begin to answer questions that weren't answered before.
And I'm guessing it's going to happen in a few key cities.
Probably, yeah. I think that's right. But where and when, I mean, having covered movements, you can never tell. You can sense that it's in the air. But what triggers it, what it looks like, and, when I covered the street demonstrations that brought down Milosevic, I was spending time as a New York Times reporter with the purported leaders, Gingich and Draskovic. But in fact, they were struggling to figure out what the crowds wanted, that it had a kind of life force of its own. And it was really interesting being around them as much as I was, because most of the time they were trying to take the pulse of the public.
I was just talking to a friend of mine who has friends that organized the transit fare protest in Brazil, and they were as shocked as anybody that this became this national movement. They thought they had this little local transit fare protest going.
Well, the PLO, I covered the first intifada in the PLO, which then was an exile in Tunis, had nothing, was as surprised as the Israelis. And while they, you know, struggled to sort of take charge of the movement, again, they spent most of their time trying to figure out where the people on the street were going. And that's how movements work. And, you know, the best leaders in uprisings can read the polls. But that's what they're doing. That's how it will happen. And when it happens, where it happens, no one knows.
And that concludes the last of the six sections of interviews with Chris Hedges. I'm going to skip through three or four questions. We'll just hear the last of the questions sent in because it gives Chris Hedges such a good chance to sum up and present his action points.
Congress seems a wholly owned subsidiary of the multinationals. Obama is pimping for GE in Africa. The Koch brothers have made a down payment on the Supreme Court. Money will control the next federal election and most of the state elections. Is there any scenario you see that will return this government to the people?
Mass protests that begin to scare the hell out of these people and begin to disrupt systems that they care about. That really is the only solution. I think they're very fragile. I think internally they know how corrupt they are, which is why they passed the NDAA, because they want to be able to pull the military on the streets, because I think ultimately they don't trust the police to protect them. And those are the sentiments of a dying elite. So I think when we begin to organize against all the formal structures of power, I think they may crumble as the Stasi state in East Germany, which when I was in East Germany appeared monolithic, fell in about a week. And it fell in a week because Erich Honecker, the dictator for 19 years, sent an elite paratroop division down to Leipzig to fire on 70,000 demonstrators, and they refused to do it. And after that, in the same way that the Tsar sent the Cossacks in to crush the Petrograd bread riots, and they fraternized with the crowd. Both Honecker and the Tsar only lasted another week in power. Once the foot soldiers of the elite will not protect the elite, they're done. And that's why we have to be nonviolent, because ultimately what we are doing is trying to create a paralysis within systems of power, whereby we speak truth, we appeal to conscience, we expose corruption, fraud, lies by those in power, so that when those forces are called into the street to stop us, they refuse to do so. That's how all revolutions happen. And that's really, in the end, what I'm calling for. I'm calling for the overthrow of this system. Let me say that again for Homeland Security. I mean, that's what I'm doing. And I'm calling for it through nonviolent means, through mass protests, because as a father of four children, I know that if we don't stop these forces, they will kill us. They will destroy the ecosystem on which the human species and my children will depend for their life. And that is really the stakes that lie before us, and why there is an imperative for all of us to take risks. And I don't like going to jail, as I have. Going to jail is more time than I care to donate to my government. But it really is the only option left. Because if we fail at this, then it's not just this particular civilization that will be extinguished, but human habitation.
You still catch me napping one day and they'll kill me.
This and all previous episodes are available for download from our MP3 archive at unwelcomeguests.net/archive. Our theme tune by Billy Bragg and Wilco has lyrics by Woody Guthrie. As ever, I hope this show has inspired you to both thought and action. I've been encouraged by the increasing download figures lately. So if you've been publicizing this show, passing the address to like minds, then keep up the good work.